The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now on KMRE and KAVZ in Deming and Van Zandt. I'm Stephanie Contouris with my co-host Tim Johnson. Dave Willingham is off tonight, and we will have him back next week. Tonight we have some very special guests in the studio, Larry Hildes and Karen Weil, who have been fighting the legal battles for a lot of people in need and activists and trainers and leaders in our community for several years. We have a lot to talk to them about. There's a lot of relevant things. We're going to start off with talking. Liz Darrow interviewed Michelle Vindiola and Yonga Subadar, and they are giving their perspective from community to community, Racial Justice Coalition, and the Whatcom Civil Rights Project on what just happened with our recent Facebook page warrant.
My name's Michelle Vindiola, and I am with the Community to Community Development and also the Red Line Sailor Sea. My Indian name is Taba Toniga, and I live here in Bellingham. And I want to share some information about the warrant that was served on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page is called the Red Line Salish Sea, formerly known as the Bellingham No Dapple Coalition. Our group is dedicated to standing up against Dakota Access Pipeline and also to other pipelines and fossil fuel extraction in this area that will impact tribal sovereignty and go against the Mother Earth. And we just feel it's really important to make a stand and to ask for better solutions for the future.
My name's Junga Subadar, and I'm with the Racial Justice Coalition and the Whatcom Civil Rights Project and C2C. The Facebook page of Bellingham No Dapple, now called Red Line Salish Sea, was not about blocking the freeway, was not about commentary on individuals. It was for the purpose of making a political statement, taking a political position about the environment, and being in support of Standing Rock. The warrant failed to describe with particularity what they would be searching and seizing in this Facebook page. And the particularity is a requirement and a safeguard that has been put in place by the Supreme Court and many other case law to safeguard that right to expression and political speech. And when it's not there, such as in this warrant that was very broad, it should not be granted. And I think there was the Herald article that mentioned that it was narrow and specific. But if you read the actual warrant, it's very broad. And what it really wants and calls for is searching and seizing of, quote, all stored content for the Bellingham No Dapple Facebook page, which is approximately 1,700 members, admins, and visitors during the time period of February 5th through February 15th. That means all profile information, including linked personal profile IDs, status updates, messages, videos, photo, articles, wall posts, event posts, comments, tags, event info, including IDs of people going, interested, or invited to the events, and discussion posts. That's hugely broad. There's no particularity in that. And they also, in the warrant, they have what they call a two-step process where they would be allowed to search all of this, but only be allowed to keep what is quote-unquote relevant to their investigation. And then the rest of the information would be sealed. But there has been case law, and the Supreme Court has looked at this as well and said that that is not a valid process. The counsel for Bellingham Nodapo asked the judge to at least allow a third party or in-camera review of that information instead of giving all that information over to the prosecutor's office. And the judge denied that safeguard even. So basically, they're going to have access to all the information, and seizing part of it and not all of it doesn't really matter because the cat's out of the bag. All of that information they've seen already.
This warrant is going to impact 1,700 people. So, and it also sets precedents for cases like this to be used nationally. And I think that's a big concern for any of our First Amendment rights, freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, and our Fourth Amendment rights, which are free from illegal search and seizure.
This creates a chilling effect, and that's why it's so important, and that's why our Supreme Court for many years have protected political speech and expression. Because what it will do is deter people from getting involved in expressing political views or opinions about their government or about other kinds of political activity, and shut down dissent. And dissent, in their eyes, what they see is against the interests that they have. And this creates a fascist society like the one in Orwell's 1984. The information that the prosecutor's office will have now because of this search warrant that was granted will not just implicate people on this Facebook page or in regards to this the particular event or protest that happened in February. They will have the identities of all these people who may engage possibly in other political speech and expression. And so if they do that, they will first look at the people that they have the names of and the identities of, and it'll make it much easier for them to go to them first whenever there's political activity or a protest or a rally in the future. That's why this is important. And that's why it can have a ripple effect of chilling all kinds of other political speech that our government, that our prosecutor's office, or our law enforcement, or our senators, like Senator Doug Erickson, does not agree with or is against their economic or political interests. And that's happened in history, where there's been witch hunts in the 50s and 40s, where they were trying to hunt down communists in our country. For sure, that's the effect it has. And we have to do everything. That's why we have to do everything we can to resist that.
Well, I just want to remind the people who have liked the page why we started the page to begin with, which is to raise awareness against the Dakota Access Pipeline, why we don't want it, and any kind of actions against the fossil fuels in this region. And now we're the Red Line Salish Sea, and with that we stand up against any kind of fossil fuels in this area. We look at why these things can be anti-Indigenous, and we need to stand together in solidarity up against any kind of anti-Indigenous policies, anti-Indigenous actions that will impact tribal nations and tribal sovereignty. And I know that the 1,700 people and even more folks out there are allies and supportive to tribal communities and tribal sovereignty, and which is why they have already liked the Facebook page. And I would request, the Red Line Salish Sea requests, that you continue to like and post and read and click on articles, not to let the warrant be a scare tactic to, which is what I think that the warrant is creating, is like a scare tactic or a fear amongst readers or people who visit the page. You know, in reality, this is a an actual chilling effect to anyone who is thinking about standing up against this government or the wrongs that are happening in the world or nationally, that if any of us feel like we want to speak out, we start to have a second thought about it because we're afraid we're going to be targeted. But I would encourage everyone listening to not succumb to bullying from the prosecutor, from the sheriff, and from Doug Erickson, because they would all like to call us terrorists if they could, just for acting on our constitutional rights.
That was Michelle Vindiola of Community to Community and Redline Salish Sea, formerly Bellingham No Dapple, and the Bellingham No Dapple webpage. And you also heard from Junga Subedar of the Racial Justice Coalition and Whatcom Civil Rights Project. The interview was conducted by Cascadia News Now citizen journalist Liz Darrow. And this is Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contours with Tim Johnson and our very special guests, Larry Hildes and Karen Weil. Welcome so much to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And so we, as Tim was talking about in a previous show, which you can find online if you're interested, we had the attorney who was defending the Facebook page from being searched and the warrant, Mike Brodsky, and he gave his perspective. And so we're really glad to have Junga Subedar and Michelle Vindiola's perspective. But I think you both have a perspective of your own, just as a catching people up. If you don't remember, there was a freeway protest this year, and the state troopers came, did not make any arrests. And so there's this investigation that the Whatcom County is sort of acting in on behalf of the state, and they wanted to subpoena the Facebook page that was the Bellingham No Dapple. There was about 150 people total at the protest, fewer than that on the freeway. There are about 1,700 people who like that page.
Right, and I would just go further and say that, you know, the issue I think here is, if you like a page on Facebook, are you making a statement that you're an organizer or involved in any way with the content of the thing that you're liking? And that, I think, was one of the salient things, is they got a whole list of names of people that may not have had any association whatsoever with the event itself.
And that's designed very specifically, as Michelle and Junga said, to chill people's First Amendment rights, to scare them away, to keep them from being involved in organizing. And it's part of a couple of very scary national trends, one of which is spearheaded by Doug Erickson and his sympathizers, is to overcharge people for minor acts of civil disobedience, minor demonstrations, minor incidents with major felonies. We saw that happen in North Dakota, where people were charged with ridiculous felonies for organizing the camp, for organizing acts of civil disobedience. We've seen it around the country. And this has been building basically since the WTO protests in 99 in fits and starts under both Democratic and Republican administrations. But it's really taken off since Trump came in. So one of the things is to do that. The second one is that the feds and state officials use these demonstrations as a pretext for gathering information, for researching the individuals involved, for coming up with charts of who intersects with who, with to pull profiles on people. And we've had instances where we've ended up suing because people who had done nothing more than acts of civil disobedience were labeled as domestic terrorists with a bunch of information that was fictitious or stretched severely. So there's a lot of stuff going on that's quite scary that this is one piece of. And the State Patrol has been doing this stuff for a while. In fact, it was the State Patrol that produced domestic terrorism profiles, along with the Pierce County Sheriff's Office and the Army, on a group of peace activists in Olympia and Tacoma, who then got targeted for repeated arrests. And these things were passed out at conferences and used to justify grants.
Washington State Patrol conferences.
Yes. So the State Patrol has been doing this for at least 11, 12 years that I'm aware of. So this is an example of that, and it's designed to scare people away. And as Michelle and Junga said, the best way of fighting it is to keep on organizing and not be intimidated by it, but to be aware and to be concerned and to fight it. But it's designed to scare people. The same way the state of Alabama tried to scare people out of involvement in the civil rights movement, and most of the case law that protects the right to freedom of association, which is what Judge Snyder should have been looking at. I apologize. I try not to criticize judges. But I think he made an incorrect decision. What he should have been looking at is the case law that says that membership lists, that lists of people contacting a website, liking a website, joining an organization, attending meetings, are privileged. Cases going back to NAACP v. Claiborne Hardware, NAACP v. Alabama, Shuttlesworth v. Alabama, the cornerstone cases that protect people's right to associate together. First Amendment has five parts. Freedom of speech, which is actually freedom of expression. It's broader than speech. It's symbolic speech and actions as well. Freedom of the press, obviously. Petitioning the government for redress of grievances, which is getting out there, doing the demonstrations, being visible both to the public, as in on the freeway, and to the government, and freedom of association, the right to meet together and gather, to organize, to plan, to discuss the issues of the day. It's a cornerstone, because without the freedom of association, the right to get together, without the government monitoring who's meeting with who and under what circumstances, you can't organize dissent against the government.
So it's clear that you are both very knowledgeable about the background of this case and in the context of where this case sits. But for those of us who don't know who you are and how you're knowledgeable, if you can just give us just a little bit of a connection to who you are and what work have you been doing that makes you the knowledgeable people you are today.
Sure, I launched right in with it. I have been a civil rights lawyer for going on 22 years now. Karen and I have been working together for 15, going on 16. And this is what we do. We represent demonstrators. We sue the police for brutality and other misconduct. We deal with the intersection between the First Amendment, the right to dissent, and the Fourth Amendment, where police action and search and seizures come in. And that's mostly what we've do. We've done it all over the country.
And that's actually fairly unusual. You probably, you know, there's maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen attorneys across the country that specialize in that specific area. And that's primarily, that's all they do. Most attorneys do that. If they do have that specialty, they don't do it full time. They'll do one case occasionally, and Larry does it full time and has done it full time now for almost 22 years.
And you don't practice just in Washington State?
No.
We have done 17 states now, plus D.C.
Plus tribal court,
too. Plus tribal court in a couple of places.
Yeah, Arizona,
Yeah, and Lummi for that matter.
Yeah, but Lummi.
And a couple of cases in Vancouver.
Yep.
And we've advised attorneys in England who do similar work to what we do, and we'll probably do it other places.
You know, that's one of the reasons why it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. One of the questions that comes in my mind is your caseload accelerating? I mean, are these sorts of violations that you speak of, are they becoming more common in our society?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's interesting. Our caseload is going nuts at exactly the point that I'm having some medical issues and I'm supposed to be cutting back, but I can't cut back. Yeah, we now have people who are arrested protesting Trump. We have people who are arrested protesting Nazis. We have people who were raided for actions they supposedly committed in past years under really specious circumstances. Mm-hmm. So yeah, our caseload, especially criminally, is way up.
The legal team of Larry Hildes and Karen Weil. And so just going back to the Facebook warrant for a minute, we've talked about it a lot before on the show. What do you see happening with this case? Is this a case that could go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I want to say one other thing before Larry gets back into the legal portion of it. What it is guilt by association. And this is something that we have fought in many cases. When the cops just love to arrest one or two people and then say, because the whole group was doing X, therefore this person's also guilty. And it's called individualized probable cause. You have to prove that that particular person did something that would warrant an arrest, okay? And again, it's this balancing act. You have 150 people on the road, some of whom might have been on the webpage, some of whom might not, but you've got 1,700 people now who are being surveilled and monitored and being put on lists. Don't just skip over that part, okay? And they will be on the list now for a very long time to come. And they might have just joined, you know, the day before the warrant was given.
Right.
And the other thing is that there was a request for that information to be sealed that was not relevant, and the Whatcom court did not approve of that.
No.
Right. And I believe that's the attorney, when we had him on, Attorney Brodsky brought that up, that there is a, I don't know what the right legal term is, but a lockbox that you could put this these names into that would have sort of an officer in charge of, so that it's just not a fishing expedition for the prosecutor anytime he wants to fish around in there, look around. Because the very nature of a warrant is to try to restrict the parameters of a search so that it's not a fishing expedition.
And
let's get back to what we're actually talking about. We're talking about people who may have committed a minor misdemeanor. Obstructing a roadway is misdemeanor disorderly conduct. It's not a federal crime. It's not a felony. I know what you want to do. Go ahead.
One of the things I always talk about with clients and whenever we're giving talks is that there's five levels of law in the country. There, and start out with municipal law, and that's where most of your traffic laws are. You then go to county law, there's some traffic laws there. You then go to state law. There's, you know, clearly when you're talking about highway speeds or not being out on the highway when you're walking, that's all state law. And then you talk about federal law, because this was I-5, there may be some federal law involved in that, but no, Larry's shaking his head.
Even
no.
If we're within the 100 miles of the border thing, that was the question.
But there are no federal misdemeanors, correct?
Exactly.
Well, there are, but they have to take place on federal land.
Right.
You can only have a federal misdemeanor in some place, like a post office, a national park, okay, a military base.
Yeah. But the thing that I'm looking at is, you know, you've got municipal law, you've got county, state, federal. What's the highest law in the land? It's the Constitution. And the Constitution has, the first Bill of Rights had 10 amendments. The founders were very clear that the 10 amendments have no particular order Just because one is 9 and one is 6 doesn't matter. They're all equal, except for one, and that is the First Amendment. And it was specifically made first because if you can't speak about what's happening, none of the other rights matter. Okay? And when somebody tells you, what I tell the protesters always, when someone tells you, you can't be out on the street because it blocks traffic, what they're saying is this little municipal law here at the lowest level of your 5 levels of law is more important and trumps the First Amendment. Trumps.
Yeah. Takes precedence over is the phrase I like to use these
yes.
days. But again, because we have so much that we want to cover that I want to just go back to, is it possible that this case could be challenged and could it go up to the Supreme Court because of that reason?
Yes. And I mean, we've not been counsel on this case, but that is what I would do. I would take it up. I would not allow this to stand. And I think if it goes up through the state system, which is where it would start out, I don't think the state Supreme Court would let this stand. It's such a clear freedom of association violation with such a flimsy pretext. I know they've tried to argue that it was reckless endangerment because there was an accident somewhere back there.
4 miles away.
4 miles away.
Where we couldn't see it.
Right. But people doing a demonstration are not responsible for everything that might occur somewhere down the line. If you block a highway at Bellingham, that doesn't make you responsible for an accident in Birch Bay.
Right.
You're just not.
Right.
Those people need to have been paying attention to what was going on around them.
And if you're driving in the Chuckanut area and you're driving by a place where there's landslides and rocks falling on the freeway, that could have been just as likely. But I just want to ask, I think you have a question, Tim. Okay, well, I just want to ask, as somebody who was on that freeway during the protest, what advice, if any, because you're also civil rights activists and you've done civil rights trainings. I was at some of your resistance trainings. What advice would you have for somebody who had been at that protest?
If the cops show up, don't talk to them. Prosecutor calls you, don't talk to them. There is nothing.
Call Larry.
Call Larry. Call Larry.
There is nothing useful to be gained, and let people know as widely as you can. Let the media know, let other activists go. Do not go through something like that by yourself, and do not think you can out-talk them. You are most likely smarter than they are. You definitely are smarter than they are. But
well, this is good for the future, but, and I know that you can't give legal advice and you're not representing anybody who was there, but I guess what I'm saying is for somebody whose information, maybe who just liked that page, their information is now under subpoena. Is there anything, we just have to sit here and wait to see what happens to our information?
No. Do a Public Records Act request and do a Federal Freedom of Information Act request. Ask how they're using that information. Ask how they intend to use that information. Be aggressive. The Public Records Act is really very, very good. And it has real teeth if they don't comply. So demand information right back.
Yeah, so the Public Records Act request is a state equivalent of the Freedom of Information Act. So if it's a state agency, in this case, Washington State Patrol, then you use the Public Records Act, PRA, to get the information that you're asking for, as opposed to going, if you want to do a federal request, then you use FOIA.
What would be your first step in pursuing a request?
This is not particularly difficult.
You send them a letter.
You send the Washington State Patrol. You can look this up online.
And the Whatcom County Prosecutor's Office and the Whatcom County Sheriff's Office.
Yeah.
A letter. You set the code.
There's a form that you can fill out, but it's also, you can do it in a letter. You can handwrite it.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be fancy.
I think that's one of the most helpful things that may have ever been said on this show. And I think it probably transcends this incident. So thank you so much for that. You are listening to Attorney Larry Hildes and Karen Weil, the team of Hildes and Weil, who are just amazingly long-term champions of all kinds of human rights violations. And we're going to get into some of that, but I want to remind you that you're listening to Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ Deming and Van Zandt. So as I was saying, there's so many things that you're involved in. And one thing that dovetails so nicely with a lot of the work you do is our weekly Fergie Report. Fergie, the man that we love, who's close to our hearts, is Attorney General Bob Ferguson. A couple things I want to mention. This week, he is suing the Trump administration over its decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program. DACA provided some undocumented minors a work permit, kept them from being deported, often to countries they'd never seen before and know nothing about. This is Bob Ferguson's 15th lawsuit against President Trump. Out of those who have been decided, they are 4-0, if you're keeping record. But the big news, and this is really groundbreaking, just came out today, that GEO, which is the second largest private prison company in the United States, runs NWDC, the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. As if you've listened to this show a lot, you know that we frequently discuss hunger strikes that have been happening all year at the Northwest Detention Center because of treatment of detainees and their rights. Now, Attorney General Bob Ferguson is suing GEO for not paying its workers the minimum wage, saying GEO is making millions in illegal profit. GEO uses immigration detainee labor to perform virtually all of its non-security functions at Tacoma's Northwest Detention Center. And that means thousands of detainees have been paid $1 a day, or in some instances just snacks or food, for labor that is necessary to keep these operations going. Washington's minimum wage is $11 per hour. I just have a couple quotes, and then we'll get into talking about it. Bob Ferguson said a multi-billion-dollar corporation is trying to get away with paying its workers a dollar per day. That should not happen in America. This is what Bob Ferguson said. I will not tolerate it happening in Washington. And for-profit companies cannot exploit Washington workers. Most of the work at the center, Ferguson said, is that detainees were asked to do the jobs. If no one volunteered, they were assigned jobs like cleaning bathrooms and mopping floors, and they said they felt like they couldn't refuse. So who wants to jump in? It's a lot. It's
We're
a lot.
We're so happy.
Okay, well, let me just say one quick thing, great, that Northwest Detention Center resistance has been ceaseless in their efforts to make the hunger strike known. And Maru Mora and Rosalind Guillen and a lot of people also worked to make this happen.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
That's fantastic. Yeah, Obama administration in its waning days had made a move towards ending the contracts with these companies for at least through DOJ. And of course, Trump immediately reversed that. There should not be anyone in the for-profit prison business. And inevitably what happens is they find ways that they can make more money. They withhold medical service. They withhold food. They play these kinds of games. These companies need to be shut down. And I'm hoping that this is a first step to shutting at least the Northwest Detention Center. And GEO's getting sued in multiple states for multiple abuses. And I'm hoping that they're going to get shut down.
And I do want to point out that this is the first case of its kind. And Attorney General Bob Ferguson of Washington State, first person to do this.
Absolutely. You should have him on your show.
We would love to have you, Fergie. And we will reach out and try to make that happen. Absolutely.
Yeah. GEO used to be
a Wackenhut.
Wackenhut.
Yikes.
Which was actually dissolved because they got such bad publicity for the stuff they were doing. And so then it got split up into GEO and one other company.
Yeah, they used to do security at the Nevada test site, among other things.
Yeah, and they did...
GEO and CCA.
Okay.
The Correctional Corporation of America. I don't remember which CCS came out of.
Okay.
But there's... All right. Sorry. Yes, there's...
I'm sorry. You said Wagenhut got split up into GEO and what else?
CCA.
Okay, so
Correctional
it's a different
Corporation
company.
Of right. America.
Which is also getting sued all over the country,
yeah.
Although not for that particular issue that Fergie has picked up,
and
which
then
I'm
they
happy
split
about.
Off CCS, which is Correct Care Solutions.
Yeah, which we're suing.
One of the most Orwellian names I know.
So they used to be one. They used to be one organization.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You are suing CCS Correct Care Solutions. Right. Telling me about that.
Okay.
What are you able to tell me about that?
We have a case against the Pierce County Jail for a guy who was legitimately in there. He did something he shouldn't have. Was awaiting. Transfer to the state prison system for a one-year term and had restless leg syndrome. CCS, one of the ways that they make... The Pierce County Jail was ordered by Pierce County to cut costs and stop losing money.
By the city council.
County council.
By the county council, sorry, yes.
I mean, a jail does not exist to make money. When you start looking at it that way, you run into... these kind of problems. So they contracted out with CCS for medical care. CCS makes money by withholding medical treatment and playing all kinds of games to cut costs, never having anyone available. Client had restless leg syndrome to the point that he could kick himself out of bed in his sleep. They withheld his medication when he was in before conviction. They withheld it again. And a combination of the jail and CCS insisted he had to stay on an upper bunk. And
so he's kicking himself out of bed.
And endangering.
And then his bunkmate, who's below him, comes out. He asked to get moved, and the jail guards refused to let him move, even though he has told them, I could kick myself out of bed.
And in fact... he kicks himself out, lands face first on the concrete floor, permanent, traumatic brain injury, broken wrist, eye damage.
He completely broke the bones around his eye.
Oh, my heavens.
So yeah. he was a mechanic, a very good one, actually. And he has permanent debilitating injuries. He can't work now.
Oh, my gosh.
So this is when you're talking about GEO, when you're talking about CSA, when you're talking about
CCA,
when you're talking about Correct Care Solutions, the people we're suing. And by the way, we had two different people who went through the Whatcom jail who both had AIDS. And this is very, very typical of jails across the country. As soon as you come into the jail, they want you to be evaluated by a nurse, and whatever medication you have, they won't give it to you.
Yeah.
And so he, the two people I'm talking about both had AIDS. If you don't get your medication within a certain amount of time, but no more than 24 hours, the medication that's preventing the AIDS from coming in roaring like a bullet trying to kill you, all right, immediately starts to come back. This one guy had this cocktail of drugs that they had been working on for 2 years to get him in balance. I'm sorry, yeah, I understand. But it just makes me so angry. And they just refused. And he had been arrested on a warrant that was more than 10 years old, so it shouldn't have even been out there anymore. Right? I mean, my God. And he could die. So then he can die for something that he's arrested for something that shouldn't even be in existence.
It was a mistake.
It's like the point that Russell Lindegan said on a previous show when I challenged her a little bit when we were talking about the hunger strike and she was talking about conditions. And I said, well, how do we know that anybody's telling the truth? And she's like, come on, would somebody starve themselves to draw attention unless the situation was so dire? And there's been at least three. The last one, I think, was a group of Cubans.
Yes.
Do you know about that?
We've heard some about it. Yeah.
So because it sounds like there's no resolution because of the Trump administration, that they don't get representation, they don't get to move forward, that they're just stuck there.
Right, exactly.
And meanwhile, the detention center keeps making money off of
this. This is a country of laws. And, you know, well, we all know Trump doesn't think he has to follow the law.
And targets whatever the groups are he thinks can least fight back.
Yep.
So immigrants.
So let's get into that, targeting the groups that can least fight back. And that seems to be like the heart of your work, is people who can't fight back. And the attitudes that we have about immigration in this country are very interesting. But I think Tim has something to say about what's maybe behind that, what we don't think about.
Well, I was giving thought to having you on, and it's great to have you on the show. But you know, we have this idealized notion about immigration in this country. It's kind of encapsulated on the Statue of Liberty, you know, that plucky people gave up their lives in order to come here to seek new freedoms, you know, to better their lives. But there are classes of people who are displaced in the world because of U.S. policy.
Oh, yeah.
War is a classic example. We decided to go to war somewhere, and we created a refugee class by doing so. We decided to support a proxy war, such as Syria, and create a refugee crisis in doing that. We ignore climate science, and in doing so, we displace millions of people around the world because we're not actively doing something about a known crisis. So there is a class of immigrants who are displaced through no fault of their own or no particular desire to come here. Yeah. What's the obligation and duty of the United States in those situations?
Well, I would like to first just pull out Puerto Rico for a moment. We have called Puerto Rico a territory. It's a colony. The UN has made it very clear for, 20, 30 years now, that we are supposed to be decolonizing. But the United States, by we I mean the United States, has
50 years,
has totally insisted that they don't have any colonies. We've been to Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is a colony by any definition of the word.
As is the U.S. Virgin Islands.
As is the U.S. Virgin Islands, as is Guam, Samoa. So, but Puerto Rico, I can speak to because I was there. For example, they were at the time when we were there in the year 2010, they were doing
the census,
right? 80% of Puerto Ricans speak Spanish. 80% of Puerto Ricans, or some percentage of that 80%, has Spanish as their first language and do not speak English very well, okay? So that starts to get an idea of what we're talking about in terms of the colonization. Every billboard about the census was in English. And every single billboard that was in English showed a white person. So it was clear.
In Puerto Rico.
They're very much pushing that the white people answer the census questions. And they couldn't care less about the Puerto Ricans who speak Spanish when that is the native language there.
To mention that they can't vote, which is huge. Like that's a primary right that
Absolutely.
All Americans should have.
But they also can't serve on juries if they don't speak English as their primary language and don't understand, because the juries are all done in Spanish. Are all done in English, I mean. So if you don't they purposely weed out native Spanish speakers because they don't want them on their juries.
Yeah. The other notable place, of course, where they can't vote is D.C.,
right,
which is a similar percentage African-American.
Taxation without representation,
yes,
as it says on
exactly.
their license plate.
So,
speaking of Puerto Rico, to go to Tim's question, I'm going to let you answer that part of it.
So, I agree. We're displacing huge numbers of people in Latin America, have been for decades. Every time we want some resource from Africa or the Middle East, we displace large numbers of people. Of course they're going to come here. I remember a BBC interview with a Jamaican-British woman on a march who was holding a sign that said, "We're here because you were there."
Absolutely.
It is logical that people will go where their money has been taken, where their resources have been taken. Where else are they going to go? And then you throw in climate change producing large numbers of refugees. So, of course, people are going to go to the places that are the safest, which are the places that have the resources. Now we're getting internal climate migration because of, you know, New Orleans right. and
you know that Florida. Some huge number of people in Houston during Harvey were climate refugees from New Orleans.
Yes.
Right.
Correct.
I was gonna say that. You are listening to the team of Larry Hildes and Karen Weil, who are a legal team that are very passionately and long-term activists, as well as representing people for several reasons who wouldn't otherwise have representation. I just want to remind you, you're listening to Cascadia News Now with Stephanie Contours and Tim Johnson, and Dave Willingham will be back next week. I wanted to say right on that point about Harvey that when people in this area express anti-immigrant sentiments, that I always want to shake people and say, look, we are human animals. We go where there's food. We go where we want to protect our children. So that's something we all have in common. And people are coming here. They're coming to Bellingham. They're coming in droves. And they might be coming from Atlanta. And they might be coming from Las Vegas, where there isn't going to be any water.
Right.
So, like, let's leave the stupid border racism out of it.
Right. Yeah. And I guess that's it's something that people should have in their minds. I think listeners should have in their minds is, you know, we've got Jose slamming into Puerto Rico. Irma, you know, did its, you know, grazed Puerto Rico. Anyway, there are people who are being displaced through no fault of their own. And I guess a question in my, you know, a question, and I don't expect you to answer it, but what's the responsibility of the United States.
Yes, absolutely. This is the point that I wanted to make about Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico was partly hit so hard because the United States, for the last 10 years, of which 8 of them were under President Obama, the people that so many folks hold up as this great hero, okay, under President Obama, they were not giving the money to Puerto Rico so that they could build the protection that they need to keep up the infrastructure that they need so that they, when something like a hurricane hits, they have water, electricity, you know, sewers that are not overflowing right. into the streets.
And then they
and
did.
Yet, yeah. I mean, this is the definition of colonization.
And then they did to Puerto Rico a broader version of what they did to Detroit and Flint. They pulled the money and decided that the vulture capitalists were entitled to their money back at the expense of the people. So they appointed an austerity board that now, unelected by anybody, that now runs Puerto Rico. And that's the Democrats. That's not even Trump. That was Obama handing it over so that the people were...
And this goes hand in glove with what I was talking about.
They dismantled the labor laws.
With the census thing, because what's happening now is you get this wave of brown-skinned immigrants coming from Puerto Rico to the United States, leaving space open for the rich white people to move into Puerto Rico.
Right.
And the thing that's causing the most work in Puerto Rico is building second homes for rich people.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's what I consider to be the kind of the counterfactual about it is in our mythology, in our national mythology, is this idea that people are pulling up stakes and they're plucky and they're coming here because of a great desire to live on the golden city on the hill. But in reality, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, are being driven to our shores because of our policies right. around the world.
Or let's be honest that there's also the stereotype of, oh, people are trying to take advantage of America.
Right.
Well, yeah. America is trying to take advantage of the everyone. World.
People are then going where their money has gone and trying to earn a living and take care of their families. I'm thinking about my father's from. My grandmother came over here at a point where there was a strict quota for how many Jews were allowed in, and she would have been turned down. My great uncle, who was figuring all this stuff out, figured out that if he paid money and bought her a second class ticket, she wouldn't get screened at Ellis Island because they assumed she had enough money. And sure enough, my grandmother, who was stone broke, got to sail up the Hudson River, get off at the passenger terminal, and was welcomed in, not because of the benevolence of the U.S., but because my uncle was smart enough to know what it took to get somebody into the country. That is no different from the people who are struggling to get here now across the border because there's no way to make a living because of NAFTA and Mexico. It is the same thing. It's a question of whether you can get lucky or not.
So, obviously, this is a subject we're all passionate about, and I'm going to ask you now to come back because we only have an hour on our light. Come back to this radio station of less than subdued excitement tonight. But there's an important issue that does sort of dovetail with environmental impact and immigration that I know Larry wants to talk about. I want to make sure that you have time to talk about an investigation that I didn't know about before you told me, and I think most of Bellingham is not aware of.
Yeah. Several years ago, the FBI started knocking at doors, including, I can give Herb's name because Herb was public. Herb Goodwin in Bellingham got visited by our resident FBI agent and Al Jensen, who's the intelligence officer for the Bellingham Police Department, and asked about a group called Deep Green Resistance. And this happened to activists all over the country. We have learned that this was an operation that was based out of Seattle, as far east as Pennsylvania and Florida, and was a pretext. They were using this fear about this group that never has actually done anything illegal. They have meetings. They talk about the need to end industrial civilization. They don't do anything about ending it other than have meetings and organize peaceful demonstrations. But they used it as a pretext to investigate the opposition to the coal terminal, the people blocking tracks in various places, systematically over a period of about
10 years? No.
Well, this went on intensively for about 2 years. But there was a lot of stuff leading up to it and harassment of activists. And then it hit the media and a parallel set of media in Canada came up with the fact that they were doing the same thing to Keystone XL activists in Canada that the RCMP was. And the switch got pulled and all of a sudden it stopped. But in the meantime, they were trying to see whether they could label groups here as domestic terrorists and charge them with interfering with a federal energy facility.
Now, and if I'm not mistaken, this idea of this terrorism charge, that takes anything that you, when you were talking earlier about the four levels of crime, that takes anything at the four levels of crime and immediately shoves it all the way up to the chain.
Right.
Right.
And makes it
exactly.
a federal issue that involves Homeland Security.
And this has been going on. There was a scandal in Pennsylvania where the director of Homeland Security was investigating anti-mountaintop removal activists in West Virginia and anti-fracking activists in Ohio. And it came to light and the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania was forced to do a press conference and fire him. But this labeling of anybody who dissents effectively as a terrorist is very scary. It's been going on. It's been building. And then they do the strangest pretext. We have a guy who we're representing now in Seattle who got pulled off a plane from San Diego to Milwaukee and dragged 25 miles into Denver from the Denver International Airport because he had supposedly on May Day 2016 thrown an unlit Molotov cocktail at a Seattle cop who was firing concussion grenades and rubber bullets and driving the crowd out of downtown. Okay. So they then interrogated him, scared him into giving the name of his ex-girlfriend, let him get back on the plane, arrested him in Wisconsin, interrogated him again, and charged him with possession of a dangerous device without a permit. Who knew you could get a permit for a Molotov cocktail?
So we just...
But it's a federalizing a local action, and they have now used this to systematically raid activists in Olympia and Seattle.
Okay, so we just have like a minute and a half, and I want to know how you're involved and how do we follow this story?
Okay. Larry's representing the one gentleman that he mentioned. We are getting calls from pretty much everybody who's being approached by the FBI, and happy to help anyone who gets approached by the FBI here in Bellingham. Again, we talked about doing the PRAs. And I have one piece of advice. It occurred to me as I'm listening to Larry. If they're going to investigate everybody who protests as if they were a terrorist, okay, then we should all protest. Let's have 100% protest in the United States.
I am Spartacus.
Clearly, it's scaring the government, which is a good thing.
And it's a great thing. By the way, in France, if, you know, any protest that they have, the government stops. And they listen, because they can get 100,000 people out in the street like that, okay? We need to be doing the same thing here.
Well, it's nice to be France right now for a lot of reasons, and maybe that's another show. I want to thank you both so much, Larry Hildes and Karen Weil, the law team that is fighting the good fight and has been for at least a decade, maybe two decades. And please come back as soon as you can. There's so much more to discuss. You have been listening to Cascadia News Now on KMRE and KAVZ with me, Stephanie Contouris, and my co-host, Tim Johnson. Cascadia News Now is edited by Dave Willingham, who will be back next week. Our godlike engineer is Devlin Sweeney. Thank you, Devlin. Special thanks to Junga Subadar, Michelle Vindiola, and citizen journalist Liz Darrow, and our fantastic guests tonight, again, Larry Hildes and Karen Weil. And if you have anything that has been stirred up, if you have a different opinion and you're tired of hearing us talk from our perspective, get in touch with us at CascadiaNewsNow.com or find us on the Facebooks. Maybe you too could be a guest. And you are listening to Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham.